I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. This weekend, the U.S. Gymnastics Championships will be in Kansas City. Thousands of people from across the nation will be here. But what does it take for the city to host such a large-scale event? Today, a look at the bidding process. We'll ask what makes Kansas City so appealing, how long the process usually takes, and how the city can prepare. Then, I have a hard time remembering things sometimes, and so do many friends my age. But how do I know if it's normal memory loss or the early stages of dementia? We'll dive into the differences and find out what to look for. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. When it comes to hosting major sporting events, Kansas City suddenly is very much in the game. Think about it. The U.S. Gymnastics Championships are here this weekend. The NFL Draft, it's coming in 2023. And get this, Kansas City is expected to win a bid to host games in the World Cup in 2026. We won't find out about that for a while to come. That's pretty big-time stuff, so you can't help but wonder what goes into the bidding process that brings major sporting events like these to Kansas City. I'll give you a hint. One thing that definitely goes into it is a lot of hard work and sweat. With us, Kathy Nelson is president and CEO of the Kansas City Sports Commission. Chiefs owner Clark Hunt singled Kathy out when Kansas City won the bid to host the NFL Draft. And yes, that's a very big deal. Kathy, nice to have you. Welcome.
Good morning.
Also here is Jason Fulvey. He's president and CEO of Visit KC. That's the city's nonprofit tourism agency. Jason, nice to have you too. Welcome.
Good morning, Steve.
Well, Kathy, has Kansas City entered a new era here when it comes to the appeal of big-time sporting events?
I don't know necessarily that it's a new era, but in the last decade, we've definitely grown and had more opportunities with Sprint Center coming online, Power and Light District, and downtown, the growth downtown makes that door much more open for us to go after different events.
I was going to say, Jason, a decade ago, this town wasn't going to win an NFL draft, was it?
No, it really wasn't. And in fact, that was about the time, the last time I was here before I made the move to Kansas City. And, you know, when they called me to take this job, I told my wife, there's no way we're going to Kansas City, right? Mm. And then I got here and found out all the hard work that had been done and how this destination has improved and all the hard sweat equity that Kathy and her team have put in. It's really changed the dynamic.
I was going to say, have you seen cities elsewhere, Jason, that have sort of moved the needle as much as this town has in recent years?
Yeah, actually, the destination that I came from, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania,
we went through
a very similar trajectory. And so I know what that path looks like. And when I saw the things that had happened here in this destination, it was very exciting to me.
Is there anything that's off limits to Kansas City now? I mean, is there any event that you would say, nah, we can't handle it?
No, I think that we need to look at everything, every possibility that comes down the pipe, right?
Mm-hmm.
There may be some really big conventions that we can't handle just because they only go to San Francisco, okay. Las Vegas, right? The high-profile events, no, I think that we can compete on a national level.
Super Bowl, Kathy, could we do it?
Not yet.
Not
Super
yet.
Bowl and or men's Final Four.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some of the restrictions and guidelines were not quite there yet, but that would probably be about it. In Super Bowl, it's not yet.
Mm-hmm. What are we missing? What's not in our menu yet?
Well, for Super Bowl, it's we're not missing anything. It's up to the NFL to decide if they're ready to go back to a cold weather city.
Oh, I see.
Yeah,
okay.
But for
that's
the men's
right.
Final
that's right.
Four, we're missing a dome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, you need a dome for
yeah.
that.
Yeah, yeah, for the Super Bowl, we certainly have the assets to handle it. It's like yeah. Kathy said, it's really up to the NFL whether they want to be in a destination.
But the
like
Sprint
this.
Center isn't closed. Is it just not big enough? Because it's not a stadium, right?
Well, for a men's Final Four, it's a minimum 60,000-seat arena.
Oh, is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
60,000 seats. And Sprint doesn't get you quite there. Yeah.
No, they're maybe at 19.
19. I was going to say a third of that. Well, our producer, Danny Alexander, spoke with Stephanie Corapin at USA Gymnastics about what they're looking for in a city when it comes to holding an event like the one this weekend. Let's listen to some extended excerpts here of that conversation, and then we'll talk about it afterwards.
We tend to start the process of looking for a city to host our events 2 years out, sometimes further out if it's an Olympic trials or bigger events. When we look at a city, one of the top things we look for is looking for hotel rooms and the availability nearby, preferably within walking distance of our venues. In Kansas City, we are utilizing over 5,000 hotel room nights. So we have a large hotel block requirement. When considering transportation, we really do like to have our events in cities where it's very walkable. When there is not the walkability, we want to make sure that there is transportation. Is there a trolley or an easy public transportation way to get to the venue? But our preference is for cities with high walkability. Then we also look at airports. Is there a major airport close by? What is the size of the community? What is the population within 50 miles, within 200 miles? And what is also the size of our USA Gymnastics membership population within that city or nearby cities that are within driving distance? A lot of times when we're looking for our events, they're combined with other events. For example, in Kansas City next week, we have our National Congress, which is an educational convention for gymnastics professionals. So a lot of times when we look for venues, we also want to make sure that there are those ancillary venues available for our other events. What's needed at the venue is to have obviously the space for the competition arena, security, medical staff. So a room for our medical staff to perform recovery services for our athletes. We also need a training venue, not necessarily in the arena, but nearby.
So I'm listening to that, Kathy, and I'm checking off the boxes here. Hotels and lodging, we got that. We got walkability, people in the region who will buy tickets for these events, multiple venue sites, and we've almost got the new downtown convention hotel. Does it seem like a stretch to me that all this is going to make a big difference, all these new things?
Oh, it
helps. The downtown convention hotel is just huge.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And like she continued to say, walkability. Mm-hmm. So in our downtown core, those athletes, their friends, their family, and all the fans being able to park their car, go to their hotel, go eat and have dinner, go eat and go to the competition, it's a really big deal.
When do we get that downtown convention hotel online, Jason? I forget here.
Scheduled for spring of next year.
So it's coming
March.
Pretty soon.
Yeah, March. That's what they're planning on March.
Less than a year away now. Yeah. Yeah. How does that change the equation for Kansas
City? Oh, it's a game
changer.
Yeah. Yeah. When you look at that asset as well as the single terminal airport, those are game changers for us, right?
Yeah, and the airport too, obviously.
Oh, without a doubt. Yeah, yeah, that's our front door mm-hmm. to our community.
You know, what's the most important thing when looking for a host city? What's your experience tell you? What do people want most when they're thinking about where to put their giant convention?
Well, the lady on that we just heard from,
yeah,
she hit on a lot of those pieces, right?
Mm-hmm.
When you're bringing a large convention or an event to a destination, they want to work with the smallest footprint possible, right? That's why that Lowe's Hotel is so important, because now we have a lot more concentration of hotel rooms directly in close proximity to the venues.
So what you're saying is you don't want to be spread out. You don't want to have people out in Southern Overland Park.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So, and think of it from a meeting planner's perspective. Do you want to contract with 5 hotels or do you want to contract with 25 hotels?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So you narrow that footprint, and then you get into those walkability factors, because then everybody wins.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You know, we talked about how the folks attending U.S. Gymnastics is going to go to the restaurants, the bars, all that stuff in Power Light. I was in a jewelry store the other day getting a battery in my watch, and 2 people walked in that were there for U.S. Gymnastics, and they're buying jewelry,
mm-hmm.
right? So the ripple effect, or what we call the halo effect,
right,
is real. People will spend money. And think about it when you go on a trip.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Do you just go to the hotel room and hang out in the hotel room? Right?
No, you get out.
Right. You go out and spend some money.
Yeah. Kathy Nelson, again, president and CEO of the Kansas City Sports Commission. How long ago did you hear of the interest in the gymnastics folks to come to Kansas City this weekend? How long ago did those conversations begin?
So our staff started working along with Jason's staff about 5 years ago. It was here in 1987. And then we continued to go out and figure out what else for Kansas City. So we're working years out. We have, someone from our staff and someone from Visit KC that they go to the event years and years form relationships, start to say, does this work in our city? Can our city accommodate this? And then when the bids come out, the RFP, the request for proposals come out, we all sit together and say, this works. We can make this happen. And then we put a bid in. You're not always successful the first time you bid. So sometimes it takes a few iterations of that or a few bid cycles to make that work.
You know, I can't help but wonder, what is that bidding process like? I mean, I fill out taxes once a year. I gather this is a little more complicated than that, Kathy. Yes. Does that go without saying?
Yeah, it does. It is interesting and complicated. There's a budget, right? And then there's all the ancillary events. And she stated on her interview, there's medical, there are practice facilities. Where do they eat? Where do we host the parties? We're doing Fan Fest this weekend. All of those ancillary events beyond the competition go into that bid. So what I think stands out with Kansas City are the relationships we have internally. Mm-hmm. I can call Jason and say, I'm really interested in salivating over the Division I Men's Wrestling Championship in Kansas City. What areas can you help us with? Then we go to the venue, Sprint Center. We go to the city. We go to Power and Light District. It takes a team to put a bid together. And it might be just like with the NFL draft. That was a four-year bid process. And it's continual work and continual to craft what we're doing and update that budget and figure out where we went wrong last time.
Those bid packages, I mean, how many pages? Can you count pages here, or is it something else?
It depends on the event. So NCAA has gotten much more streamlined mm-hmm. with their championships. So that is mostly done online, but it's mm-hmm. still probably 50 to 60 pages of work plus a budget. The figure skating that we held in 2017, that was a few hundred pages of bid work.
Wow. I assume that once you've done one or two of these, that maybe doing more helps because you can pull information. And does that
absolutely
sort of make sense here?
Absolutely. And yeah. And we continue to meet, both of our teams meet and say, what are we prepared to do? How do we update this page? The new airport needs to be updated in all of our bid proposals. The new hotels needs to be updated. So we're ready to go. But we're always looking years out at what's available to bid on and which sport we think will work in our city. Like we host USA Fencing in November. Huge sport for us and for our city. It's a massive event. Mm-hmm. A lot of times people don't know about that, but it took us years to get that. And now they love our city. They love working with Visit KC and the Sports Commission, and they come back.
You know, I was wondering, Jason, to what extent do out-of-towners have this misperception of what Kansas City is all about? Because I think you've said that Kansas City doesn't have an asset problem. It has a perception problem.
That's right.
What do you mean?
Yeah, so when I told all of my friends on the East Coast that I was moving to Kansas City, they said, oh, there's like cows walking down Main Street and cornfields, right? So unfortunately, that's the perception that a lot of people still have about the Midwest. And we all know that that's not the case in KCMO, right?
But it's a problem when you want to get...
Perception's reality, right? So how do you change that? Well, you change that by getting high-profile events like USA Gymnastics and the NFL Draft, and you get people here to kick the tires. Mm-hmm. And then they go back with a different perception, and what I've been calling that who knew moment, right?
Yeah. How much competition is there for these moments, Kathy? I mean, these different events. I mean, how many cities go after the NFL draft? How many cities go after U.S. gymnastics? And
I mean, that's an open field,
right?
And it changes daily because there's other destinations that are improving their product just like we are, and they're getting into the game that maybe they weren't 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm. We shared with the NCAA on our last bid cycle that we know every city has great venues. So we have to figure out how we stand out and what's different about us, because there are dozens and dozens of cities that want these events.
And you do that how? Whether it's the two or three things you point to that allows Kansas City to stand out from the crowd.
Well, one is walkability,
right?
Our downtown core, how great we treat fans when they're here. And the other thing that separates us is how well we treat the athletes. We continue to have the NCAA tell us, my gosh, the athletes love coming here.
Yeah.
The venue is fantastic. The hotels jump in. People know that they're in our city. And that's a really big deal when someone says, oh my gosh, you know, you're the soccer player from Oklahoma that's here for Big 12 Women's Soccer. That resonates and continues. Now they will tell their friends and family, we want to come back.
Let's talk just for a minute. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're talking this morning about how Kansas City attracts major sporting events like the NFL Draft, U.S. Gymnastics Championships coming up this weekend here in town. You know, I think I know the answer here, but these events are so desirable, Jason, because they generate tons of money for Kansas City. Give me some more detail on that. What will this weekend mean for Kansas City? What would the NFL draft mean, or what do you have there?
Yeah, so U.S. Gymnastics has estimated about $5.6 million in economic impact to the community, right?
Yeah, a million and here and a million there, and pretty soon you're talking real money.
Well, and that goes back to what I said before. That's direct impact. That's not the halo effect, right? All the people spending money in the jewelry shop and going to the grocery store and things like that. So that compiles pretty quickly. You know, NFL draft, we don't know what that number is yet, but Nashville estimated there is at 133 million of impact. Wow. But then think about the exposure that we get, and that's advertising that neither one of our budgets can afford, right? Mm-hmm. So when we're on national television and they're showing those events and they're showing skylines of beautiful downtown KCMO, we couldn't afford to do that.
Like the soccer crowds in the Power and Light District, which were shown repeatedly. I mean, that's
over
really
and over
something.
Again. Yeah.
When the World Cup comes, isn't that sort of a critter all onto itself? That's a whole different league, isn't it, Jason?
Oh, yeah, without a doubt.
Yeah. I mean, how many people see that? That's a worldwide audience, I think, for that event.
Right. And that not only helps our image, right, but that also helps our partners, like the airport. Right. Mm-hmm. So as they start seeing that, wow, it's an international destination, then you start getting interest from other carriers to say, well, maybe we should take a look at that destination because there might be an opportunity there to add a lift to the airport. So it's all interconnected.
I was going to say, when you get turned down, Kathy, is there a way to find out what it was that knocked Kansas City out and how you can address that going forward?
Absolutely. And that process has gotten a lot better over the last few years. When the NCAA releases the cities that they're awarding championships to, if you've bid for that, they will call you and walk you through what you did well and what are the gaps. Mm-hmm. So then we learn after each bid process, just like with the NFL draft. When we were turned down the first couple times, mm-hmm. we took that as a not yet, not a no. And then worked with them. What else do we need to bring to the table? What do you need to understand better from our city? And again, where are the gaps? So yes, we do learn on every one of the bids that we're not awarded what we need to do better.
You know, we've been talking about the need for transit and a walkable downtown. How about simple and pure politics? I mean, relationships with people, how much of a factor is that?
Huge factor.
Mm-hmm.
Huge factor.
Clark Hunt has to get along with the other owners to bring the NFL draft here.
And I have to get along with the NFL events team. So there's a trust factor.
Mm-hmm.
And as you get to know the event people with USA Gymnastics and the championship and the NCAA and the committees that make those decisions, they need to know us. They need mm-hmm. to know when they come to our city that Jason and Kathy are right here with our staff and Brenda Tennant at Sprint Center right. and their staff to jump in. It becomes it may not be the absolute perfect fit, but we know these people, we like these people, and we're willing to take a chance on that.
Clark Hunt, as I mentioned in the opening, singled you out for your work on bringing the NFL draft here. I gather that was a pretty intense few weeks, or what can you describe what that was?
That's an intense few years.
if you want to be honest about it.
Yes. Yeah. One, I was extremely flattered that Clark did that. That meant a lot. But it did. It got to be frustrating. And then it got to be almost like a game. And being an athlete, I don't enjoy losing. So it was one of those, okay, we're going to get this across the goal line somehow. And those relationships became friendships within the NFL league office. And it became, hey, I'm going to be in Indianapolis. Will you be there? Let's go to lunch. So it was mm-hmm. one of those opportunities for us to continue to grow and actually to help the NFL as well go, what does this look like in a city? And Commissioner Goodell said it was so great. He goes, the NFL draft's a chameleon. It will grow to fit the city of where it's awarded. So we saw that happen in Nashville.
Mm-hmm.
We saw it in Chicago, Philadelphia, Dallas, Nashville. And, you know, as it continues to grow and morph, that's where we become much stronger because our city can be able to, you know, we're able to handle that kind of thing. And And it's so exciting for me to see Clark now high five people and have that big smile on his face that we've done this.
Yeah.
So your question about how intense was it, you know, it's kind of like giving birth, right? You forget about it and you move on.
It was just like giving birth. Okay, yes. There's our quote of the day. I mean, what Kathy just said is interesting to me, Jason, because again, I'm not an intense NFL fan, but I follow it and I watch the NFL draft, and I wonder sometimes why I'm watching the NFL draft, but it's become such a giant spectacle, you can't keep your eyes off it. But my point is, this event is morphing year over year. It is now, as Nashville demonstrated, a really big deal. 10 years ago, it was starting to become a big deal, but it wasn't like it is today. Can you anticipate how big this thing's going to be 4 years from now?
No, I don't think there's any way to even anticipate how big this thing can get. You know, it's just like Kathy said, it's really up to the destination to be able to absorb as much as they're willing to give you, right?
Yeah.
And we've got to expand our reach. But, you know, this is one of those defining moments for Kansas City to put us on the map, to get past that perceptual challenge that we're facing.
The NFL draft you're talking about.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. Why has it become such a big deal? I mean, why am I watching that thing? And so I know the first five players. I know I'm sort of watching the ins and outs and who's up and who's down. It becomes this, you can't stay away from it.
Because
I'm not sure why.
Because the NFL is such a good marketer. And they've got you. They got their hook in you, right?
Yeah.
And they realized that they had a product that was appealing to a wide variety of people, and then they just built on that, right? Then they turned it into an event. Mm-hmm. If you remember the original NFL drafts, it was one day, and it was in New York. It was always in New York, right?
And it was just the guys getting around the hotel room, right? And just talking, I'll take this guy, you take that guy.
And you tune in just to see how your team did, and then you tune back out. Well, now they realize that this is an event that they can really market, and they did a really good job at it. And it's exciting now, right?
Hmm. Yeah, when it comes down to it, it's a business meeting is all this is. It's a three-day business meeting that millions tune into.
Yeah. Jason, before you go, I just wanted to ask. I said at the top that, and it bears repeating, that Visit KC is the city's nonprofit tourism agency. Do you have enough money to do what you need to do?
Wow, that's a loaded question.
Yes, it is. Yeah. Well, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but it's an important part of where we are right now.
It is, right? So if we take a look at all of the assets that have been developed and you add in the airport that's being developed, you're looking at about a $9 billion investment into our community that directly impacts what Kathy and I do every day, right? Mm-hmm. So we have to make sure that we capitalize on those investments and we have a good ROI, right? Mm-hmm. If you're looking at it from a business standpoint. When I look at our budget at Visit KC and even Kathy's budget, and we compare ours to our competition, we are behind, right? Mm-hmm. We are on the low side of things. And the fact that we're still being incredibly successful tells you what a good team we have, a good network. And when I mean team, I don't mean just Visit KC and the Sports Commission, but all the other folks in the community.
So your money comes from where then?
Yeah, well, our funding stream is a portion of the hotel tax. So mm-hmm. it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. The more people we put in hotel rooms, the more money we're able to get back in. But when we look at where we are compared to some of our competing cities, we're about half of where they are. You know, you look at Denver. Denver is one of those destinations that everybody tries to compare us to.
Mm-hmm.
And if you compare our hotel inventory right now, we're basically Denver.
Mm-hmm.
And their budget is more than double ours is, right?
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And it's really not – we do a great job with the markets that we're in, but we need to start looking bigger than that. We need to expand our reach. And when you want to expand your reach in sales marketing, you need additional resources to do that.
Okay. We're going to leave our conversation right there, and it was a good one. Congratulations on all your success. Everyone's excited about this weekend with the gymnasts here. That's Kathy Nelson, President and CEO of the Kansas City Sports Commission. Jason Fulvey, President and CEO of Visit KC. Thank you both very much. Good luck this weekend.
Thank you, Steve.
Don't break too much of a sweat, Kathy. No more of that. Okay.
Got it.
When we come back, we're going to talk about memory and whether I'm losing mine a little bit. Is that normal or do I have a problem? I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday on the show, we heard new music from one of Kansas City's greatest jazz pianists. That's Jay McShann. And we sat down with one of his daughters to recall his legacy. You can hear that again at kcur.org/uptodate. KCUR has a new way to stay up to date on all things up to date, and all you have to do is check your email. Go to kcur.org/Kraske and sign up for our weekly newsletter. It's got exclusive content from me and the rest of the up-to-date team. That's kcur.org/Kraske. Well, the up-to-date staff is lovingly referring to this segment as, does Kraske have dementia? I've wanted to do this one for a while for a very simple reason. I don't remember things as well as I used to, and it's bugging me. Lots of my friends in their early 60s are telling me exactly the same thing. So is there anything to worry about, or should I start stomping on the panic button? With us, Dr. Christine Boutwell is the Interim Medical Co-Director of St. Luke's Marion Block Neuroscience Institute. Dr. Boutwell, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thank you for having me, Steve.
Dr. Jeff Burns is back with us. He's Director of the KU Alzheimer's Disease Center. Dr. Burns, welcome.
Thank you, Steve.
You know, just guessing here, Christine, that when people at cocktail parties learn what the two of you do for a living, that you get asked about this with some regularity?
Absolutely.
Do you? And what do you say?
Well, it depends.
It depends, of course.
There's always a context.
Yes, yeah.
So it depends on what kind of issues you're having, how much that's impacting your day-to-day life.
Yeah.
It's really, if it's impacting your life, then I start to worry.
Is it, you get asked this a lot too, Jeff, when you
all
go
all the time.
Yeah. And you just, people find out and they just want to know, hey, doc, what do you think? I have a hard time. Yeah, whatever, right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, everybody has forgetfulness and they're all, and everybody's worrying about this right now.
Yeah, that's because what Alzheimer's is still such a terrifying disease.
It is.
It scares people right to their knees, you know?
It's one of the most feared diseases.
Yeah.
It is a scary thing.
What are we seeing in terms of the occurrence of Alzheimer's nationally? Going up, going down? What are we seeing?
Yeah, the numbers are rising rapidly, and
that's because
our population is aging. You know, the number of people over the age of 65 and the number of people over the age of 85 are rising as fast as any other segment of the population.
And the boomers are getting older.
The boomers are getting older, Alzheimer's is an age-related disease, and that's just fueling a huge increase in the number of people with Alzheimer's.
Yeah. Well, I imagine, you know, Christine, that I'm like a lot of people. You know, most days I'm going 1,000 miles an hour, and in the mornings I take a couple of glucosamine pills, and some morning it's 5 minutes later and I'm thinking, did I take those two glucosamine pills or did I not? And what should I be thinking about there?
Right. I mean, that I even have that thought lots of times.
Okay.
So
I feel better. That
yes.
helps.
Yes. So really, if the memory loss is impacting you, and something that I've really found is patients themselves that truly have beginning dementia are generally not necessarily aware. Their family is the ones that notice these problems. Other people may notice their problems. They may intimately be aware in the beginning. However, I think a lot of problems with forgetting whether you took your glucosamine is that we're too connected all the time. We're with our devices. We're not getting proper sleep. We're multitasking constantly, so we're not getting the proper rest. So that's a function of multitasking, I like to say, that type of forgetfulness. But when it's really impacting your ability to function in life, then it's a concern.
You know, I've had this thought before, Jeff, that this notion of what Christine just said, that we are constantly multitasking, trying to do three things at once. So many of us are doing that. Can that cause issues with your brain? Are you overloading the circuits or am I being silly?
Well, so, I mean, what happens there is your attention is pulled in a lot of different ways. And
mm-hmm.
so attention's a key part of memory. If you're not paying attention, you're not going to remember.
Mm-hmm.
But inattention is not a sign of Alzheimer's disease, or you know, it's a sign of being distracted.
Yeah.
So what, you know, when we get worried about memory loss, it's when it's not inattention, when it's trouble with the brain putting new memories into the memory banks, which
yeah.
is different. There's we try to work out and distinguish between those issues. But as Dr. Boutwell has said, you know, the key is, are we seeing interference with daily function, with the things that somebody's always done? Are they now having problems doing that?
Like, well, give me an example.
Well, let's see, you know, balancing the checkbook, navigating around, finding your way around town, you know, unfamiliar areas, forgetting how to get through Kansas City when before that was something somebody did very easily. repeating conversations, asking the same question over and over again. That's probably one of the earliest signs that we'll often see is somebody will say, wake up and say, now, what are we doing today? Ask their spouse, what are we doing today? And then 10 minutes later, ask again and again and again. And that's because the brain is not encoding that information and putting it into the memory banks.
I was going to say, Christine, what happens? Because a few years ago, as a reporter, I had phone numbers of politicians off the top of my head. I knew all kinds of stuff. And then suddenly, my colleague and I, Dave Helling at the Star, we would talk some days. He's like, who was that politician who served as state treasurer? We used to know this stuff off the top of our heads. Then suddenly, we had to start looking it up. Why does that happen?
I mean, that can be a normal function of aging.
Sure.
Our brains are at their peak when we're around 20 years old.
Oh, is that right?
We begin to lose neurons.
And it's downhill from age 20?
Well, I may be wrong on that exact date, but, our neurons, we lose them normally. There is a normal function of aging where we're not able to do all the things we were able to do before. Mm-hmm. However, with dementia illnesses and things, there are abnormal proteins and different processes that are happening in the brain that are then making those connections probably not possible. So it's normal to not be able to do exactly everything you did when you were young.
I was going to say, you're saying that is the way we work, that most people, by the time they're hitting 55, 60, 65, they're beginning to maybe not be quite in terms of, they can't remember every single phone number they used to know.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, Jeff.
What happens with age, the kinds of things we see that occur with age in memory are more trouble with working memory, which is the ability to hold information in the memory banks for a short period of time and then use it. So the old-fashioned example is looking up a phone number in the phone book, walking across the room and dialing it. So that's working memory. That gets a little less efficient, holding a little bit of information in the memory banks. And then the other thing that really changes with age is retrieval of a memory. So retrieval of a name, or a memory is a little slower. So what you're describing is that sort of nuisance of it's a little harder to pull that information down. Even though it's in the memory banks, it's a little harder to retrieve it. And that's something that's pretty universal. I call it the tip of the tongue syndrome. Mm-hmm. And it's not something that really is a strong sign of Alzheimer's disease. And so people don't really need to worry about that. It's when that information is not in the memory banks and not being put into the memory banks when we get worried.
Well, let's talk about Alzheimer's in just a moment here. And let me just remind our listeners that you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And we're talking this morning about memory loss and when do you know if you have a serious problem or if it's just part of the aging process. If you want to join our conversation, we'd like to have you. 816-235-2888 is our phone number. Or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. I'm visiting with Dr. Christine Boutwell. She's with St. Luke's Marion Block Neuroscience Institute. And Dr. Jeff Burns with the KU Alzheimer's Disease Center. Doing some background reading on this last night, Christine, I came across this line, and I'm quoting, memory loss is often one of the first signs of dementia. Is that an accurate statement? Does that sound right?
Yes, Steve, that's accurate.
That's what you're saying here.
That's definitely accurate. But memory loss, again, impacting your day-to-day function. And when we're seeing patients with Alzheimer's disease or one of the most common types of dementia, it's not just memory loss. They have other trouble functioning. They have trouble with speaking and recalling words, what we call aphasia. They have trouble recognizing faces of people that they know and agnosia, and they have trouble writing, and they have trouble with other executive brain functions just besides memory. So memory loss by itself does not equate to dementia.
Dr. Burns, Jeff, I had some questions about Alzheimer's and what we know about that. Is it connected to hereditary? Is it hereditary in nature?
Well, yeah, genetics plays a role. Mm-hmm. We know that. And in some very rare cases, families will have it in their genes. And if they inherit that gene, they'll get the disease. That's very rare. And for the rest of us, it's, you inherit a risk. You inherit sort of a genetic background risk. Which the way you maybe think about high cholesterol and heart disease, your chances go up if it's in the family, but it's not inevitable for most people.
Do we know what causes it?
I guess the short answer to that is no.
And really?
We've been arguing this for decades, the field has. Amyloid, there's things that build up in the brain, amyloid plaques, and then something called neurofibrillary tangles. And the field's really focused on those two features as potential causes of the disease. But we're still debating it. And really, one of the things that's holding the field back in terms of new therapies is we don't really have a precise understanding of what initiates Alzheimer's and what's the cause of Alzheimer's.
So is it fair to conclude then that if you don't know exactly what causes it, that finding a cure is all the more difficult?
It makes targeting, you know, a cause much more difficult. And so we hypothesize, you know, things like amyloid may drive the disease, and we've been going after amyloid for the last 15 years and coming up empty on that front. And so now we're hypothesizing other things.
Maybe when you say amyloid, you're talking about what?
There's a protein that builds up in the brain in people with Alzheimer's disease called amyloid, and accumulates in the brain. There's other proteins as well, and there's other things that go awry. But amyloid has been the dominant focus of therapies in development for the last couple decades.
I'm going to ask you about more about a cure in just a moment, but let's go to some phone calls here at 816-235-2888. What causes memory loss? That's our topic today. Bill from Leawood. Bill, you're on Up to Date.
How are you doing? Very good topic. Thank you for taking this on. We treat Alzheimer's and depression and other diseases, neuropsychiatry and neurology diseases, using a device called transcranial magnetic stimulation. This is by the FDA, and it's about to be approved for Alzheimer's. I wondered if you guys knew about it, number one. Speaking of what causes it, we are more targeting tau protein versus beta amyloid, but really both of them, and we look at it in the MRI to see whether or not we're changing the brain back to where it was. So currently our success rate with people up to mid-stage Alzheimer's from pre-Alzheimer's is roughly 2.5 years of activities of daily living being restored. In other words, middle names, names of friends, family, what street you live on, your social security number, your balancing, your checkbook. So we've done about 13 patients. A company called NeuroAD out of Israel has an application, a new device application.
Bill, let me see if I can get Dr. Burns to respond. Do you know what the therapy he's talking about?
Yeah, TMS, transcranial magnetic stimulation.
Explain that to me in a layman's terms.
Basically, it's you put a device on the skull, basically around it, and you magnetically stimulate the brain.
To what end?
To change the way the brain is sort of there, you know, those areas of the brain are firing, and so you can actually modulate aspects of the brain through these magnetic impulses very safely. It's being used in depression, as the caller just mentioned, and then there's some interest in Alzheimer's, and I think there's some hope. I mean, the trials need to happen before we know if it really is going to impact the disease, but there's a good reason to be very interested in pursuing that,
Christine,
as a research.
Are you
project.
Interested in that? Are you watching this from afar, or yeah?
I mean, I would echo Dr. Burns in definitely using it in depression, and we've definitely had experience with that at St. Luke's. So, but looking at it further with more clinical trials.
Have you tried it at St. Luke's
for depression?
So, what impact does it have?
There has been impact in treating clinical depression that has failed other medical therapies and been resistant to therapies, yes.
How consistently?
I cannot tell you
the
science numbers.
Gotcha. Bill, thank you for the call. Let's go to Elizabeth from Paola on the Kansas side. Elizabeth, good morning.
Hi. I wanted to ask, I have a sister that has Down syndrome, and Down syndrome is 95% correlated with Alzheimer's. I wonder what you've learned from the genetics of studying those people. Seems to me like I don't hear about that very much. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Elizabeth. The connection between Down syndrome and Alzheimer's.
Yeah, no, she is right. Every person with Down syndrome, if they live long enough, they develop the amyloid plaques of Alzheimer's disease in their brain, usually by the age of 40. And then if they live long enough, they more often than not develop Alzheimer's disease. The majority, if not all, will develop Alzheimer's disease. And the link there is Down syndrome has three, patients with Down syndrome have three copies of chromosome 21, which is a gene that has an amyloid precursor protein gene on it. And so that is thought to drive an increase in amyloid production in people with Down syndrome.
Christine, I'm wondering, you know, in your work, when someone has been diagnosed with Alzheimer's, or you're pretty sure that's what is going on, how do you break that news? That must be a difficult moment.
Yes, it's always a difficult discussion, but I think it's paramount to be very direct and upfront with the patient and the family about the concerns. I think it's a good time, maybe in early forms of the disease or early stages, that patients have the ability to pretty much make their decisions about where they want things to go. If things are correct and things do tend to progress, that they make decisions about their, you know, living will, their estate, you know, that they are an active participant if they can. You know, I think that that's important. And just to start providing education about how to manage and cope as things go along.
And to be as aggressive as you can in terms of staving it off or staving off many of the effects.
Correct. There are some medications that can potentially maybe slow progress. They've been around throughout my whole clinical practice time. They have not produced significant impact, but they may help with behaviors and slowing progression of the disease. It's certainly not the cure that we want. You know, we want, our drive is to fix people. We can't do that, but how we can help them cope and mitigate symptoms and
You sort of hear people talk that, you know, keeping your mind active is the key. And, you know, people do crosswords and math with at least part of their motivation is to stave off dementia. Is that effective? Does that really help?
I think the clinical trials regarding, you know, cognitive exercises, so to speak, are somewhat maybe not clear. However, it's definitely known that increased or higher level of education and cognition to begin with, and actually increased aerobic exercise and physical activity throughout midlife really can maybe be a decreased risk factor for developing dementia later on. Okay. So
that's interesting. Yeah, Jeff?
So, yeah, I mean, this is our research area at the KU Alzheimer's Disease Center is lifestyle. How does lifestyle impact the brain and the health of the brain? And so we're undergoing very large studies of exercise and brain health and really trying to definitively prove that. We've got a lot of data that suggests it very strongly. So we have ongoing trials in actually sleep, diet, and exercise.
That's interesting.
But I tell all my patients, yeah, there are drugs. We need to use them to help slow the symptoms. They don't cure it. You know, you should do everything you can on a lifestyle front in terms of exercise, keeping your brain active and eating right. And then I think it's really important to participate in research and help move the field forward.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we need to get to a cure. And the number one thing that slows us down more than anything else is finding volunteers for our studies.
Can you envision a cure in the next 5 years?
Yeah, I mean, we're going to get there. I don't know when.
Mm-hmm. But you're confident that's going to happen in your lifetime.
I'm confident. I think it may be more complicated than, you know, one drug to cure all the disease, Alzheimer's disease. I think we're going to understand Alzheimer's as multiple diseases and go after those individual, you know, diseases in different ways.
So different people have different forms of the same thing.
Yes. And we have a long way to go to really understand that. But that, I think, is in our future. And I do think that more effective treatments are in our future.
But you need folks to take part in research, and how can they do that? If they can hear that, where do they go to help out with that?
Well, they can look us up on the internet, KU Alzheimer's Disease Center. They can call us, 913-588-0555.
Yeah.
We've got many trials and lots of opportunities, and they can be a part of the team and moving the field forward.
And you need folks.
Oh, we need them. Yep.
Okay. Melissa from Overland Park. Melissa, you're on Up to Date.
Hi there. I have heard Alzheimer's referred to as type 3 diabetes, and I'd like to learn more about that.
Yeah, so that's a great question, and we have a study underway right now where we're using a diabetes medication to see if that helps individuals with Alzheimer's, and that's you know, where we are now, but that, that basically we've been for the last 15 years studying aspects of metabolism and how that relates to brain health. And that's another theme of our Alzheimer's Disease Center. Our scientific theme is metabolism. And so, yeah, there's a lot of links between diabetes and Alzheimer's. And that idea of type 3 diabetes is that there's insulin resistance in the brain as opposed to in the body in people with Alzheimer's disease.
Dr. Botwell, how confident are you that a cure or cures are coming down the pike?
I mean, I'm always confident that we're going to continue to progress in science and come at cures, especially in neurology, neurology being a cutting field. In my career, we've made great progress in multiple sclerosis and the way we treat stroke. So I think we can also do that with dementia. As far as, you know, vascular risk factors, there's other types of dementia. Alzheimer's is one of the most common type, but there's vascular dementia. And very clearly addressing vascular risk factors such as diabetes, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, healthy lifestyle, diet, exercise.
Right.
Those are very, very important also, which really are going to what probably Dr. Burns is working on with the metabolism in some of his trials.
Okay, great information. We're going to have to leave our conversation there. That was the voice of Dr. Christine Botwell, interim medical co-director of the St. Luke's Mary M. Block Neuroscience Institute. Dr. Botwell, thanks very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
Dr. Jeff Burns is director of the KU Alzheimer's Disease Center. Dr. Burns, thank you.
Great to
be here.
Appreciate
it very
much.
You bet. Up-to-date listeners who miss my writing should subscribe to my newsletter. It's got exclusive stuff from me and the rest of the up-to-date team. Go to kcur.org/Kraske to subscribe. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Emily Aiken. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up-to-date.